But then, what is a poor church to do? You ban a book, you burn a man, and still the ideas will not go away. Sir Isaac Newton once wrote, "If I have seen farther than others, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." Copernicus and Bruno were such giants. Another, Johannes Kepler, 1573 to 1630, German astronomer and astrologer. The two crafts had not yet parted company. As a matter of record, esoteric beliefs played an essential, if somewhat hidden, role in the beginning scientific revolution. Mastery of nature became the motivating force uniting natural magic and early science. Of particular significance was the revival of interest in Pythagorean mathematical mysticism. Pythagoras, Greek philosopher, 6th century BC, often cited as founder of Western science and Western mysticism, discovered the intriguing fact that musical concords, those we now call the octave, the fifth, or the major third, represent simple but exact numerical ratios, like 2 to 1, 3 to 2, or 4 to 3. From this and other phenomena, they deduced that all things are fundamentally numerical, to be understood by or as number. Above all, they reasoned, the majestic and regular cycles of the heavenly planets embody number, and therefore should make perfect music, the harmony of the spheres. Far purer than produced by our imperfect earthly instruments. However, this pure harmony, consisting of each planet producing or singing a single unchanging note, depends upon the planets moving in perfect circles at constant velocities. Well, why perfect circles? Because again, the ancient Greeks believed the heavens to be perfect, Plato's idea or form, and therefore they must exhibit perfect form, the circle. Quite obviously, in real life, the planets display a shockingly bad form. Not only irregular movement, but in the case of Mars, retrograde loops through the background constellations. Both Aristotle and Ptolemy attempted to compensate for these irregularities, bad manners, by constructing their elaborate universes with a multitude of spheres and epicycles and all manner of face-saving devices. Despite their best efforts, the universe still appeared uncommonly rude with its irregular behavior. When Copernicus proposed a sun-centered universe, he did so precisely because it made it easier for him to believe that the planets did move in circles, as described by Pythagoras. Without too much exaggeration, you could say this underground esoteric tradition, Pythagorean number mysticism, helped shape the mathematical reality of the newly emerging worldview through its influence on the founders of the scientific revolution. Johannes Kepler, an avowed Copernican, had but one passionate objective in life: to prove the planets moved in perfect circles around the sun, and thereby tune in to the harmony of the spheres. He may have sought the harmony of the spheres, of the heavens, so assiduously, because he found so little of it on Earth. Born near Stuttgart, Germany, about 50 years after the start of the Protestant Reformation, Kepler's life took on the proportions of a perilous journey between the Scylla rock of Catholicism and the Charybdis whirlpool of Protestantism. The Protestants hated and feared the Catholics, who, primarily through the Jesuits, sought to regain lost souls and lost land. Mutual vituperation arose to a murderous intensity. Whore, assassin, adulterer, bestiality, dung were added to the lexicon of theology. Then, among the Protestants themselves, the Lutherans and Calvinists hated each other and killed each other in the name of Christian love. Of course, everyone despised and persecuted the Anabaptist and Unitarians. One observer called this obscene religious conflict theological rabies. Add to this witch's brew the political ingredients. Unlike France, England, or Spain, Germany had not yet formed a nation, but still consisted of a feudal grab bag of principalities, petty dukedoms, and city-states, sharing a common language and not much else. The only authority they recognized, when it so pleased them, was the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, that Voltaire characterized as not holy, not Roman, and certainly not an empire. Nevertheless, this empire still held sway over most of Central Europe. Switzerland, Germany, Luxembourg, Austria, Bohemia, Moravia, and Hungary. Each country torn by the same religious strife as Germany, the scenario for a fanatical religious war. Such was the life and times of Johannes Kepler. His father had been an army officer and now a tavern keeper, who still dreamed of lost glories on the battlefield. Johannes proved to be no solace, having been smitten with smallpox at an early age, which left him with arthritic hands, impaired vision, and generally poor health. Quite obviously, not officer material. Still, he must have shown some promise. The local ruler, a duke of the province, thought he might make an effective Lutheran minister and paid for his education at Tübingen University, one of Germany's most famous theological centers. But the theologian's heaven was soon abandoned in favor of the astronomer's heavens, after a professor of Ptolemaic astronomy secretly converted Kepler to the forbidden Copernican theory. His new mission: prove the Earth moves in perfect circles around the sun, and thereby tune humanity into the harmony of the heavenly spheres. unfortunately, Europe had little need for astronomers. The entire Holy Roman Empire sanctioned only one imperial astronomer, a position currently held by an eccentric Danish nobleman, Tycho Brahe. So with no private income and no social connections, Kepler had to settle for the pragmatic reality of teaching Latin, rhetoric, and mathematics at a state university in Graz, Austria. He managed to earn a little extra by editing an annual astrological calendar. Within a year, he married a widow with a daughter, and in due course added six children of his own. Dreams slip away quickly when confronted with a household filled with crying babies. But somehow, in the midst of such domestic turmoil, he wrote his first book, Mystery of Cosmography, passionately advocating the Copernican system and speculating on the nature of a harmonious and mathematical universe. That's certainly not the most diplomatic way to advance his career. He sent copies to Brahe and Galileo, but the only tangible results took the form of excommunication by the Lutheran Church for his defense of Copernicus. Then a year later, a new archduke came to power in Austria, Ferdinand, a conservative Catholic, who immediately exiled all Protestants from his domain. Kepler and his young family joined the multitude of refugees streaming through Central Europe. Homeless, penniless, the excommunicated Kepler had no choice but move in with his mother for a long year of desperate poverty. And then came the miracle. A turn of fortune that abounds in fairy tales, but seldom happens in real life. Emperor Rudolf II, impressed with Kepler's book, invites him to the Imperial Palace in Prague to become the assistant to Tycho Brahe. The year of his appointment, 1600, marks the year they burned Bruno at the stake. Royal patronage would protect Kepler from such persecution, Lutheran or Catholic. Still, it was not an easy transition from a destitute schoolmaster to an improvident courtier in the extravagant royal household of the Habsburg Emperor. And furthermore, Tycho Brahe did not manifest any great joy upon meeting Kepler. A formidable figure under the best of circumstances, Brahe had gained a deserved notoriety for his pride and temper, exemplified by the gold and silver nose he so proudly displayed, obtained after his real nose had been slashed away in a duel. Despite his rakish reputation, he had to be acknowledged as the most brilliant astronomer of his age. Without a telescope, which Galileo later invented, he cataloged the stars with an accuracy hitherto unknown, meticulously tracing the comet of 1577. He proved comets were celestial bodies moving in fixed courses and not portents of doom, as previously believed. In 40 years, he had compiled the most comprehensive observations ever made on the movement of planets. So consequently, when he told Kepler, quite bluntly, that he did not believe the sun resided in the center of the universe, and denounced Copernicus as a fool and a fraud. Kepler had serious doubts about how long he would remain an assistant. The emperor intervened in his own bungling fashion, calmed Brea, sent him back to his castle, and assigned Kepler and his brood of children to the servants' quarters. His first responsibility: prepare an astrological chart for the emperor, who confided that he never did have much confidence in Brahe as an astrologer, not after he predicted the death of Sultan the Magnificent, only to learn the Sultan had already died. Hardly an auspicious beginning for Kepler's career as an astronomer. But within a year, he had gained the begrudging respect of Brahe for his mathematical ability and his imagination. Then Brahe died under the most bizarre circumstances. During a banquet given by Baron Rosenberg, Brahe, as usual, drank huge amounts of wine. And in the pride of his manhood, he refused to relieve himself and burst his bladder. On his deathbed, he bequeathed his astronomical observations to Kepler and begged him to find an answer to the movement of the planets. His last whispered words: let me not seem to have lived in vain. The emperor appointed Kepler imperial astronomer. His golden years, a dream fulfilled. With Brahe's comprehensive records, he could now prove the Copernican theory, that the Earth and the other planets moved in perfect circles around the sun. Once Brahe, in a rare display of comradeship, told Kepler that Mars was the key to the mystery, because its apparent motion seemed most anomalous, abnormal, with its retrograde loops. That is, sometimes Mars appears to actually move backwards in its orbit. Explain Mars' orbit, and everything else would fall into place. So for the next several years, Kepler studied Brahe's charts, trying first one equation and then another. Altogether, he tested 70 hypotheses with no positive results. Finally, he had to admit failure. Regardless of his own fervent convictions, the only thing that he proved is that the planets did move around the sun, but not in perfect circles, nor at a constant velocity. They were wrong, all of them. Pythagoras, Plato, Aristotle, Ptolemy, even Copernicus, they were all wrong. And then one day, while despondently doodling over rejected mathematical equations, he drew the figure of an ellipse. And in that one inspired aha moment, it all became clear. He had, as he said, seen into the mind of the Creator. Of course, Mars moves in an elliptical orbit, not a circle, with the sun at one focus. Naturally, the sun is off-center in the ellipse. Therefore, Mars' distance from the sun varies as it moves through its orbit. That explains Mars and all the other planets' irregular movement. which had so bewildered and distressed the ancient astronomers. Now, true, the velocity of the planet varies in its orbit, but it is a regular variation and could be calculated and predicted. Kepler had indeed found the mathematical harmony he sought. Well, what then happens to the music of the spheres? Being a musician himself and steeped in the music of his time, which was the high point of the great polyphonic vocal tradition, he conceived the idea that as the velocities of the planets vary, so the notes they sing must vary too. Perhaps God chose to have them vary in order to create a celestial six-part harmony, a sublime celestial motet. At any rate, from his concept of ellipses, he devised what became known as the first two Kepler's laws of celestial motion. First, as we have seen, each planet moves in an elliptical orbit in which one focuses the sun. Second, each planet moves more rapidly when near the sun, and a radius drawn from the sun to the planet covers in its motion equal areas in equal time. Then it took 10 more years to devise the third and final law. The square of the time of revolution of a planet around the sun is proportional to the cube root of its mean distance from the sun. If you're unfamiliar with this law, it's rather difficult to comprehend through the air. An illustration may help. Since Mars is farther from the sun than Earth, it takes 1 88 hundredths more time to revolve around the sun, so that a year on Mars equals about two of our Earth years. Following Kepler's third law, we square the figure 1 88 hundredths, obtaining 3 53 hundredths, and then extract the cube root 1 52 hundredths. So, the mean distance of Mars from the sun should be 1 52 times that of Earth. And it's true. The equation works not only for Mars, but every other planet in the solar system, even for the hypothetical 10th planet not yet discovered. If, as some scientists say, there may be a million inhabitable planets strewn throughout our galaxy, Kepler's laws would apply to all of them, or to the solar systems of a billion other galaxies. Kepler demonstrated that the human mind is capable of understanding the universe, or, as he puts it, the harmony of the world, the title of his last book, in which he summarized his findings. One can forgive his pride when he wrote in the preface, "The die is cast, the book is written. To be read either now or by posterity, I care not which. It may well wait a century for a reader, as God has waited 6,000 years for a discoverer." End of quote. By sweeping away the debris of previous centuries, Kepler presented new vistas, new challenges, and prepared the way for the birth of the Newtonian universe. He revealed a cosmos of order in which the same laws rule the Earth and the stars. Remember Dante's moon boundary, separating the finite, corruptible elements of Earth from the eternal quintessence of the superlunary regions. By erasing this unbridgeable gap, Kepler restored unity to the universe. Not content to merely describe the revolutions of the planets around the sun, he asked the question, why? What causes the planets to remain in their orbits? Kepler suggests that the sun, through some mysterious power or virtue, compels the planets to hold their orbit and not fly haphazardly through empty space. Observing that the planets move more slowly the farther they are from the sun, he postulated that this power diminishes with increasing distance. The basis for Newton's gravitational theory. Even while proclaiming his celestial vision of harmony, Kepler's personal life collapsed into shambles. Emperor Rudolf II died. After considerable intrigue, Kepler's nemesis, Archduke Ferdinand, the man who banished him from Graz, ascended the throne. The new emperor swore to bring the Holy Roman Empire back to the Mother Church, or be damned in the process. He succeeded only in damning all Europe with a 30-year war between Protestants and Catholics. Overall, the carnage and wanton destruction were greater than men had ever wrought in one generation in any land before. The population of Germany and Austria declined from 21 million to 13 million. Throughout the empire, hundreds of villages were left standing without a single living inhabitant. And once again, Kepler became a refugee among thousands of refugees who sought some bit of safety before the invading armies. His wife and several of his children died in the epidemic sweeping the devastated land. And to add to his mounting troubles, his mother, now 74, was accused of witchcraft. In his hometown alone, about three women were tortured and killed as witches every year from 1615 to 1629. So, only after 13 months of arduous defense and well-placed bribes did Kepler manage to save her life. Now reduced to absolute poverty, Kepler ended up as a camp follower of General Wallenstein, for whom he cast horoscopes. Physically and mentally exhausted, he finally succumbed to fever. He wrote his own epitaph. I measured the skies, now the shadows I measure. Skybound the mind, earthbound the body rest. All traces of his grave were obliterated by the war.